Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Kernaghis, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Good to be here.
Dr. Keith Barr is the head of the Functional Molecular Biology Laboratory in the Department of Neurobiology, Physiology, and Behavior at the University of California, Davis. He is a renowned scientist in the emerging field of molecular exercise physiology and is leading a team of researchers attempting to develop ways to improve muscle, tendon, and ligament function. Our interview with Keith went more than 2 hours, so we decided to divide our conversation with Keith into two parts.
In part one of our interview, we talked to Keith about some of the fundamental discoveries that he has made on how muscle grows bigger, stronger, and more fatigue resistant.
In part two of our interview, we will be talking to Keith about his most recent research, which is looking at how to determine the best way to train and what types of foods complement training to decrease tendon and ligament injury and accelerate return to play. This work not only has the potential to improve muscle function, but also can improve people's quality of life, especially as we age. But before we get to today's interview with Keith, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who've subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews that are piling up on iTunes. As usual, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews, with an eye towards selecting the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker Norsk Soul. The review is titled The Truth in Great Detail. It reads, "These podcasts go into great depth on the topics and try successfully to put the discussion in terms that non-scientific people can understand. As a physician, it is a great resource for identifying sources for further consideration with the goal of providing my patients with well-designed study results that can change their lives. As a pediatrician, the ketogenic approach to weight loss has been nothing short of miraculous for those who embrace it fully. Information from these podcasts has helped open up a long-neglected aspect of medicine, food as medicine. Keep up the great work."
Well, thank you, Norsk Soul, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to today's interview with Dr. Keith Barr.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. This is your host, Dawn Kernaghis, and joining us today is Keith Barr. Keith, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And also joining me today is Ken Ford.
Hello, Dawn. Good to be here.
So, Keith, I understand that you grew up in Canada. So what were you like as a kid?
Oh, boy. So I was not a typical Canadian. By that, I mean that I did not play hockey for 80% of my life. Instead, I was a basketball volleyball player. So I spent most of my time in the gym running around and trying to figure out how you could basically grow up and just get the chance to play sports if you weren't great at any one sport, but you were good at a bunch of them. So you have to come up with a creative way when you're not great at something to figure out a way that you can do the thing that you love to do, but still within reason. So that's how, you know, you kind of switch things around and go from the idea of being an athlete to maybe being behind all of the athletes that are doing great things.
So what about science? Were you interested in science as a kid?
Yeah, I was interested, but we just started our quarter here and I told all of my students that I wasn't a great student just because I didn't spend a lot of time doing all of the work that I was supposed to be doing. The work was relatively easy in class, so I didn't have to focus too much on it. So that just meant that there was more time for me to do the more active things that I like to do. As far as science, probably didn't really pick up on the science component until I got to college and I took my first sports science class. And that was a real turning point for me because that was the one class where I actually paid attention to everything. And I can still remember the one question that I got wrong out of all of the exams that I took. So that's probably a good sign that I'm doing something that I really liked.
Sounds like you found the right path. So after high school, speaking of which, you crossed the border to attend the University of Michigan, where you earned a bachelor's degree in kinesiology. So how did you decide on that major? And is Michigan where you first became interested in the science of how muscles work?
Yeah, exactly. So I ended up at Michigan because we had family tradition there. My mom had done her postgraduate work there, and that's actually where they were when I was born. So I was actually born in Ann Arbor and then grew up in Canada. I went there with the idea of being a physical education teacher or something like that, and that was where you went, was the kinesiology department. We had the opportunity to have, you know, great athletes in the group with me. I remember orientation and looking over, and there was a young man falling asleep all the time and having a real hard time, and that ended up being Desmond Howard, who ended up going on to win a Heisman Trophy and become a ESPN commentator. Mm-hmm. So we had athletes like this, you know, at this incredible level. I also got there at the same time as the University of Michigan won the national championship for basketball, so a little bit different than what happened yesterday, but you know, so it was a very rich environment for the athletic component of it, and so, you know, being in the classes, those were the classes in the kinesiology classes where I really started to get excited about the possibility of science. Thought for a while about changing to become a medical doctor. Did actually intern as a surgical assistant and went through a lot of the medical profession. And it really, to me, wasn't as exciting, because basically what I saw of it was doing the same thing a lot. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about the science component, I liked the human body, but I liked trying to figure out how the body worked. You know, I played sport, but then I also was a strength and conditioning coach with the football team. And I was really, really curious about as to why, when we put different athletes onto the same training program, why is it that some of them grow big and huge and strong and others just stay pretty much the same size, and they might get a little bit stronger, they might get a little bit bigger, but it wasn't the same response. So even though we seem to be giving them the same stimulus, they were getting very, very different responses. And so that was really my first foray into trying to understand what was happening within an athletic body. And then I had the opportunity to work in the laboratory of one of the researchers there, a man named Timothy White, who's now the president of the Cal State University system. And what he was doing was he was really getting in and trying to figure out what was happening in the different muscles. And I get to see the surgeries and help with the surgeries. And again, those things really stuck with me and really made me curious and interested in trying to figure out how muscle worked.
It sounds like you had an incredible experience. And did you play any sports while you were at Michigan?
Yeah, so I was on the volleyball team there. It wasn't a scholarship team, so we were just a club, but still it was a great experience. It's the same kind of experience that I had had as a basketball player in high school. I had gone to Michigan hoping to be on the basketball team, but I realized soon after arriving that that wasn't going to happen when I was playing with some of the players, and I said, oh, I got about the same skill as this guy, but he's 7'2", and I'm not 7'2". The chances of me actually being able to do this is not as high as I'd like.
So what led you to travel across the country to the University of California, Berkeley, and that's where you earned a master's degree in human biophysics?
Yeah, so there, what I was looking for was really trying to understand basic biology of muscle, because the U.S. isn't necessarily a leader in this area. Most of the people, as I've come to learn while I've been in this field, most of the research is actually done outside of the United States. And so one of the places where I found that people were doing good research was at Berkeley, where they had a man named Professor George Brooks, who had done all kinds of research into whether lactate was in fact bad for your muscles and caused soreness and all of that. And he had really done the lion's share of the research as to why we produce lactate and how we take up lactate. And then the mentor that I had at Michigan, Tim White, had moved out to Berkeley. And so this was a good opportunity for me to explore trying to figure out some muscle physiology within a somewhat familiar environment, even though it was in a very different part of the world.
And then you returned to the Midwest to attend the University of Illinois and received a doctorate in 2000 in physiology and biophysics. So how did you decide on Illinois for your doctoral work?
Yeah, so what I had been looking at was I was looking at kind of basic responses in muscle to injury in Berkeley. And then what I was doing in Berkeley is I took a really exciting course on developmental biology and cell biology. And this was right around the time where people were discovering that there were a couple of transcription factors that could turn any cell into a muscle cell. And I was really fascinated by this. And I was looking for a place to do this new thing that was happening, which was people applying molecular biology techniques to try and understand muscle. And one person who was at the University of Illinois in Chicago, she had just returned from Australia, where she had done a postdoc with one of the leaders in the world in molecular biology of muscle. I thought that that would be a great place for me to start to do a little bit of molecular biology myself, to learn some of the techniques, to learn a little bit more about how muscle works on a molecular level. And so that was a bit of a chance that we took. It's a little bit risky when you're the first PhD student for a new faculty member, but it's also one of the great opportunities because they have a lot more time than they're going to have later on in their career. They can teach you things and show you things, and you can have better discussions. And so I really benefited from that.
Your PhD work focused on the effect of resistance exercise on specific molecular markers that are related to muscle growth. And in particular, you identified that mTOR complex 1 was activated in response to resistance exercise and that the activation was proportional to the load across the muscle. Can you talk a little bit about this work and its significance?
Yeah, so what we did in this during my dissertation was used a little bit of what I had done as a strength coach. And as a strength coach at Michigan, we weren't just doing traditional lifts where we do, say, squats and deadlifts and things that are your basic Olympic lifts. We were doing things that were designed, and a lot of times we didn't even use weights. They were just designed to load the muscle as much as possible and work the muscle to failure. And so a lot of the times I was just pushing on the athletes. And so that's called manual resistance. It's using muscles to fatigue and strengthen other muscles. And so when I started trying to figure out how to model this, I took a look at some work that had been done by one of the forefathers of the field, a man named Frank Booth, Professor Frank Booth. And what they had done is they had used electrical stimulation to cause all of the muscles of the leg to contract. And because animals like we have bigger calf muscles than we have shin muscles, when you stimulate all of the muscles of the leg, the calf is bigger than the shin muscles. And what happens is the calf muscles will pull against the shin muscles and cause them to lengthen. So that really increases the load across those muscles. So I modified this and created a model where I could put electrodes into the thigh of animals and we could just do some stimulations. And when we stimulated, what would happen is the animals would point their toes, all of the muscles of the leg would contract, and because the calf muscle was stronger, it would pull the shin muscles and it would lengthen them. So that's really the highest amount of load. It's what's called a lengthening contraction where the muscle's trying to shorten. But because the load is greater than it can handle, it's going to actually lengthen. And so we had two muscles that were lengthening in this way. We had three muscles that were shortening. Two of them were doing a lot of work, and one was just a kind of a helper muscle that was just in there. It was contracting, but it really didn't have to do much load. And then what I did was I did a stimulation training plan where I stimulated them twice a week for 6 weeks, and then we took out all of the muscles of the leg. And what we found is that the muscles in the front of the leg that were undergoing these lengthening contractions, they would hypertrophy about 16%, 15, 16%. One of the muscles in the back of the leg that was working pretty hard, but not too hard, it would hypertrophy about 8%. And then the one that was the little one in the back that was still exercising, but it didn't have much load, it actually didn't change in its size at all. And so what we had was this system where we had one muscle that didn't change, two muscles that changed about 16%, and one muscle that changed about 8%. And what it did is it gave us this dose response in the same individual animal. And then what we could do is we could look for things that if we did the stimulation and we looked at, say, 3 hours later or 6 hours later, can we find things that whose change really correlates with what we see as far as the muscle growth? And right probably about a year before I really got into the research in my PhD, they discovered a couple of proteins that were important in protein synthesis and really in the process of translation. And these were basic proteins that people were just discovering that regulated translation. And so what we did is we tried to really figure out what was going on in some of these proteins. And we looked at one of them called the S6 protein kinase. And we looked at it, and at the time there weren't antibodies that were specific to its phosphorylation state. But what we could see is when we ran a gel, it would shift up in the gel. And that's indicative of it being phosphorylated. And it's phosphorylated by a protein called mTOR. And it specifically, when mTOR is in complex 1, it's going to phosphorylate this protein S6. And what we found is that if we looked at 30 minutes or 3 hours or 6 hours after a single bout of exercise, that the shift in that S6 kinase, or the activation of mTOR, correlated beautifully, perfectly with the increase in muscle mass that we saw after 6 weeks. It's not very common when you're doing biology that you get a correlation of 0.99. And that's what our correlation was between the activation of mTOR by the single bout of exercise and the growth of muscle mass by 6 weeks of training. And so for us, this was a really interesting finding, because basically what it was suggesting was that either whatever turned on mTOR also caused muscle growth, or mTOR itself could cause muscle growth.
That must have been exciting. A discovery for you. It must have been surprised at that degree of correlation.
Oh yeah, it was outstanding. Of course, you know, I'm in the family business, so both my parents are professors, but they're humanities professors, and specifically my mom's a social scientist. And when she was reading my dissertation, she said, I've done something wrong in my work, because there's a correlation of one, and the only time that you can get a correlation of one is when you've asked a question improperly, and so there's only one possible answer. And
that's
for
right.
for a social scientist, that makes sense, because if you ask a question where there's only one sociologically acceptable answer, everybody's going to answer in one way. And so that's the only way you can get that kind of a correlation. And so I was trying to explain to her that actually in the physical sciences and in physiology, actually you can get these high correlations without asking your question wrong. So I'm probably one of the few people who showed their dissertation to their parents and had them tell them that they had done something wrong in their dissertation. But
well, my mom delights in telling me I've done things wrong, so it might be a trait.
Mine too, if it makes me feel any better.
Keith, can you explain the two basic ways of activating mTOR complex 1 in skeletal muscle? And are these two merely additive, or together do they elicit a greater muscle protein response than sort of the sum of their parts?
Sure. So it's a great question. So there's really three ways that we can turn on mTOR. One is by amino acids. And so that's basically, for in humans especially, that means what you're eating. The second one is through growth factors. Things like insulin can activate mTOR directly. And that makes sense, because insulin is a hormone that helps you store things within tissues like fat and muscle. And so what the signal is that we want to store amino acids for later. So insulin helps to activate mTOR to store amino acids as protein in muscle. And then what we and others have discovered is that there's a third mechanism, and that's by the mechanical loading. And so what that means is that when we do exercise, we activate mTOR. And the mTOR activation by exercise actually is very similar to the mTOR activation by insulin. And so what this means functionally is that if you're activating mTOR using your exercise, that your insulin response actually is no longer needed. Your insulin or IGF-1 work the same way. And you might remember an incredible sprinter athlete by the name of Marion Jones, who was actually put in jail for taking IGF-1 to try and improve her performance. And she was doing that because what people had shown is that if you increase IGF-1 activity or levels in muscle, the muscle will grow 2 to 3 times bigger. And so a lot of people took those molecular findings and thought, okay, if I add something like a growth factor like IGF-1 or insulin to my exercise program, that I'm going to get more of an effect. But what we and other people have shown is that when you do the mechanical loading, it turns on mTOR, and it turns on mTOR in a way that prevents IGF-1 or insulin from actually doing that. So the insulin or IGF-1 effect, the growth factor effect, and the loading effects, those are very similar. So they do the same thing. What's unique is the effect of amino acids, and amino acids activate mTOR in a distinct way. So amino acids activate mTOR by moving mTOR to its activator. The resistance exercise or the growth factors activate mTOR by moving an inhibitor away from that small molecule that's going to activate mTOR. And so if you do amino acids together with resistance exercise, you get a bigger effect on mTOR activation, on protein synthesis in response to the exercise, and over time on the amount of muscle growth that you've got. So there's a beautiful review on this by a colleague by the name of Naomi Cermak, who showed that if she looked at all of the studies that had ever been published with doing exercise and amino acid or protein supplementation, that what it showed is that you would add an extra kilogram of muscle mass over a period of 8 to 12 weeks if you took protein together with your exercise rather than just doing one or the other. And so what you can get is you can get the amino acids together with the exercise are additive, so they will add together to give you more mTOR activation, to give you more of an increase in synthesis of muscle protein, and it'll help you to grow your muscles bigger than just doing one or the other. That's the basis for all of the amino acid supplementation that are out there to improve muscle mass and strength. The one little caveat there is that the insulin, if you're just feeding, the insulin and the amino acids are also additive. So what you're doing is you're choosing whether you're activating the mTOR by the insulin or by your exercise. And the one big difference that we've found and that other people who study mTOR have noted is that the effect of exercise is actually a lot longer than the effect of feeding or insulin or growth factors. So if we put in a growth factor or if we eat something and insulin rises for a half an hour, we had a very transient increase in mTOR activity. Maybe for an hour, maybe for 90 minutes, mTOR activity will go up. When we do resistance exercise, that mTOR activity, especially in people who haven't done the exercise before, mTOR activity can be up for 12 to 18 hours. And so there's something very specific about a mechanical load that is activating mTOR and is inducing growth. And it's actually not just seen in muscle cells. If we apply a suction to cells in other parts of the body to provide a mechanical stimulus, you can actually see a similar activation of mTOR and growth of those cells. So there are different ways that, and this is conserved across different cells, that we can either activate mTOR and cause growth using a mechanical stimulus, using a growth factor stimulus. Those two things, they use the same mechanism to activate mTOR, so they don't add up together. But either one of them, together with amino acids, you're going to get an additive effect.
So Keith, as we discussed earlier, research from your laboratory has identified the mTOR complex 1 S6 kinase pathway as a central mechanism of muscle hypertrophy following resistance exercise. However, there are recent studies that have suggested that we may be overly focused on mTOR when it comes to muscular hypertrophy, and that other mTOR-independent mechanisms may also be at play. So for example, rapamycin has been shown to only partly inhibit the increase in muscle protein synthesis following resistance exercise. So what other mechanisms might be involved, and what in particular excites you about the future of this field of study?
Oh, that's a great question. So it was first shown in human by Blake Rasmussen that if you give mTOR inhibitors like rapamycin or mTOR complex 1 inhibitors like rapamycin to people, when they do resistance exercise, you don't see the increase in protein synthesis about 5 or 6 hours after. And we did the same thing in rats where we did the exercise. In the controls, at 6 hours, you see this nice increase in protein synthesis in the muscle. That means the muscle is probably going to get bigger. And then when you treat them with rapamycin, you block that completely. The interesting thing happened when we looked out further, about 12 to 18 hours later. And what we found, as you said, is that the rapamycin didn't block the effects of the resistance exercise when we looked out 12 or 18 hours later. That's really interesting because you still have this increase in protein synthesis at that time. It makes us also think of work that we did with endurance exercise where we had animals run on a treadmill And running on treadmill is not something that you think of as building a bigger muscle mass. We showed that protein synthesis in the muscle goes up, possibly to fix any damaged proteins or something like that. And that when we treat it with rapamycin, we didn't block the protein synthesis response. And so it's becoming clear that there's a whole lot of ways outside of mTOR that we're activating protein synthesis. And that there's really good information in human data that says that if people have taken muscle biopsies from human subjects who have done resistance exercise, and they look at mTOR activation and they look at protein synthesis rates, there's not always a really good correlation there. And that correlation goes down a little bit even more as we age. And so this has brought into question the idea that mTOR is required for muscles to grow, or whether potentially that it's just that there are other ways that complement what's happening with the mTOR. mTOR is definitely important for the feeding effects. Every time we feed, we're going to get an increase in protein synthesis within our muscle, again, to store those amino acids. And that's completely dependent on mTOR, because if you use rapamycin, you block that completely. What we're finding with our resistance exercise is what we're doing is we're kind of upping the effects of each of the mTOR responses to the feeding. But then this independent of mTOR part becomes really, really interesting, because it's happening 12 to 18 hours later. If you think about how people do their strength training, they're maybe going to strength train for, 20 minutes, three times a week. If you have a lot more time, maybe an hour, three times a week, maybe four times. But still, there's long periods in between those workouts. And so the question is, what's more important? Is it going to be the mTOR activity, or is it going to be whatever's happening later on at this 12 to 18 hour time point? And a lot of the focus there has been on a process called ribosome biogenesis. And the ribosome biogenesis process, if you think of it, is what we're doing normally is we're taking messenger RNA and we're putting it into a machine, and it's producing protein. And that the machine that we put it into is the ribosome. If you've got a factory and you've got three machines that you can work, and you've got two workers, if you bring in another worker, you can increase your output. And in this case, how much protein those machines are making. But if you bring in four, five, six new workers, there's no room for them to do anything. And so you don't increase protein synthesis anymore. What you have to do at that point is you have to bring in new machines. And the idea of ribosome biogenesis is that you're increasing the number of machines that you have to make protein within your muscle. And a number of people have shown that when you increase the number of ribosomes that you have, you can synthesize protein better. And that each time you eat, you're getting the activation of mTOR. If there's more ribosomes, that activation of mTOR is going to result in more proteins being made. And as a result of that, you're going to have a bigger effect on protein synthesis. And what we had found is that when we treated with rapamycin, we didn't block the ribosome biogenesis effect. And if other people have done experiments where they look in old individuals, and what they find is that if you don't increase the number of ribosomes you have, you don't increase your muscle mass as well. Mm-hmm. And so this is a really interesting possibility that what happens with this long activation of mTOR, as well as we also see activation of things like MYC, which is a proto-oncogene, or a gene that's associated with cancer that's known to increase ribosome biogenesis, that when you exercise, you get all of these growth stimuli that in cells that aren't muscle are associated with cancer. Because what cancers are doing is the same thing as what we're trying to do in muscle, is we're trying to grow quickly. And so what's happened is when we do the mechanical stimulus, we do resistance exercise on a muscle, what we're doing is we're setting in motion all of these mechanisms that are designed to cause growth. And that's good for our muscles growing bigger, it's good for us growing stronger, it's good for us living longer. And what we're doing is we're co-opting a lot of the things that kind of get used by cancer cells to increase growth rate. And that's things like mTOR, MYC, other things like notch signaling, and other interesting signaling components that come in. And that's where a lot of the research is pushed towards now, is moving away from mTOR as the only thing to trying to discover what the other things are. What are the new things? What are those exciting new opportunities to maybe get in there and figure out, okay, if this is why we're seeing more growth, maybe if we come in with this nutrient or that nutrient, we can augment it. We can increase the growth response.
So, Keith, after Illinois, I understand that you went to work in the lab of John Halsey at Washington University in St. Louis, who is known as the father of exercise research in the United States. So isn't he the guy who discovered that when you do endurance exercise, you get more mitochondria in your muscle?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So he published a very famous paper in 1967 that showed when you put rats on a treadmill and you have them run for a long period of time, it's beneficial, and one of the beneficial effects on muscle is that you get more mitochondrial protein. And in that study, over 12 weeks, he got about twice as much mitochondrial protein within the muscle of the animals that ran than the animals that didn't run. And so what he was doing at Wash U was basically he had been at Wash U since that 1967 paper. And while I was there, he was recognized with what used to be the IOC Scientific Medal. And so that's the International Olympic Committee. He got a gold medal around the time of the Sydney Olympics. And basically, the medal was given to him as part of a prize that was associated with the best and most influential research on and science based on the Olympic ideal. So how are you improving sports science and exercise and our understanding of exercise? And it was really spectacular to be there at the time because he got the first gold medal of the Olympics. It was a full kilo of gold. We put it on the scale to make sure that it was actually that. And then on top of that, he got a cash prize. But for most of us in the laboratory, the most impressive thing was that he got to go to the Sydney Olympics. He got a pass that got him into any practice or actual event that he wanted to go to. And on top of that, he got to carry the Olympic torch. So we were all extraordinarily jealous.
Wow. STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. When you were working in this same lab, you described for the first time that PGC1-alpha was upregulated by endurance exercise. Can you elaborate on the role of PGC1-alpha just briefly?
Yeah, sure. So there's a Harvard researcher named Bruce Spiegelman who had discovered that when you put animals that have lots of brown fat into a stressful situation, like you put them into the cold, what happens is those brown fat stores, they become bigger and they use tons of energy and they suddenly develop all of this mitochondrial mass. And so in all hibernating animals, the way that they keep making heat, even when they're sleeping, is they use this type of fat called brown fat. And the reason it's called brown fat is because it's dark color. And the reason that it's a dark color is because it has a huge number of mitochondria in it. What Spiegelman had discovered is that when you cause the cold stress and you increase this stimulus to make more mitochondria within the fat, what seemed to control it was this protein, which is called the PPAR gamma coactivator, became known as PGC1-alpha. And this was a really interesting discovery. And so having been in Dr. Halsey's laboratory and having been trained in molecular biology, basically he brought me in as a way to maybe come in and try and figure out what is the molecular mechanism through which the endurance exercise causes mitochondrial biogenesis. How do you go from exercise to an increase in mitochondrial mass? We had read the paper from Spiegelman's labs and thought, okay, this is a great candidate here. And so what we did is a simple experiment where we had rats swim for 6 hours. That's an exciting thing to do because you sit in a room with rats for 6 hours who are in a big water container, and you just are sitting there while you just make sure that they always come up to the top and take breaths and make sure that everybody's still surviving for the whole time. And then at the end, you get the enjoyment of drying them off with a towel. They absolutely love it. They're like little dogs. They're wonderful little creatures. And then what we did is we waited 6 or 18 hours after the exercise, and we collected the muscles. In this case, we collected the triceps because that's what they were using a lot for swimming. And what we did is we looked to see the gene, the expression of this gene, PGC1-alpha. And what we found is that, sure enough, the form that everybody had identified, that Spiegelman identified, actually went up about twofold over those 18 hours. But then the most interesting thing is that when we looked further down, and this was back in the old days where we were doing northern blots, and this is an old way where you run a gel with all the RNA in the cell, and then you use a radioactive probe to kind of find where and how much of the message that you're looking for you had in those samples that you looked at. And sure enough, we found the PGC1-alpha where it was supposed to be, but then because we had this big membrane, what we did is we looked further down, and there was this huge increase in something that wasn't even present in the muscle at rest that reacted with our PGC1-alpha probe. Because it goes from almost nothing to something that's just hugely, you know, it's an infinite increase if you try and quantify it, so we couldn't quantify it. But what we were looking at was this huge increase in this smaller gene. And then what I did is I spent a lot of time using shorter and shorter probes to different parts of the PGC1-alpha RNA. And what we discovered was that the PGC1-alpha that was the shorter version, actually it was shorter because what had happened is we had cut out, or there was a different transcriptional start site, and the result is that you lost a big piece of PGC1-alpha. And that happened to be the exon 8 that they lost. And that's important because exon 8 in PGC1-alpha has an inhibitory domain. So what we do with our exercise is we produce more of this gene PGC1-alpha, which actually can cause an increase in mitochondria that Dr. Spiegelman had shown. But it's not that we increase just the overall PGC1-alpha. It's that we make a new form of PGC1-alpha that's shorter and it's more active because it lacks this inhibitory domain. And so that was basically, I remember walking into the boss's office, and it was basically my last day on the job because my wife had already moved to Michigan, so I was in the process of moving. So I would go and basically sleep in the laboratory for a week and do all my work and then fly back home. And so I was doing this, and this was my last visit to St. Louis before that whole time was going to end. And that's when I had discovered that the exon 8 was gone. And I came into the office, and I'm telling him all about it, and he just sat back and he had this huge smile on his face. And those people who know the boss know that that doesn't happen very often. So, you know, it's a really significant moment. And he looks and he says, he didn't even really look at the data. He just looked at me and he was like, "This is how I know you're doing what you should be doing, because you are so excited right now by this finding that there's nothing else in the world that can give you that excitement." And it's absolutely fundamentally exactly right. Is, you know, as a lot of my friends would say, if I won the lottery, I would still be working. I just would be working more because then I wouldn't have to do all of the other things. I could just focus on doing the research that I love. And that's what Dr. Halazy saw. And that's what he was, you know, to be honest, he seemed to be as excited about that as this huge finding that basically, you know, that was in 2000. Around 2001, 2002. And he had been working on that problem since 1967. And this was really kind of one of the big moments in trying to, you know, figure out how we get that change that you saw in 1967. And I was really fascinated by the fact that he seemed to be as excited by my pleasure and my excitement from the discovery as the discovery itself. And for me, that was a huge mentoring moment as well.
Yeah, that definitely says something good about him.
Mm-hmm.
We know that most sports require a combination of both strength and endurance for our optimal performance. And this brings us to the topic of concurrent training. Can you tell us the story of Robert Hickson, a former postdoc in Dr. Halazy's lab, and what sparked his interest in concurrent training?
Sure. That's one of my favorite stories. So Bob Hickson had been a really incredible researcher. He had done his PhD, and he was, at the time, there was only one place that anybody who'd done exercise and wanted to do exercise wanted to go for their postdoc, and that was Halazy's lab. But it was a little bit more interesting with Hickson because he was a power lifter. And so Higson, at the time, was just a huge individual and massively strong. And this was totally exciting to Halsey, because I have to say that the first question that Professor Halsey ever asked me was, what was my bench? So how much did I bench press? Because, you know, at the time I had been a strength coach and all of these things, and that was what he was most excited about. So when you can imagine that you have this huge individual, Bob Higson, coming in, and Halsey is all excited that he's got this, you know, young, strong person in the laboratory, and Higson wants to make a great impression. So Wash U is located in St. Louis, right outside of Forest Park, and there's a 10-kilometer running loop or walking loop around the park. And the boss would always go out and do his runs. And so Higson wanted to make a great impression on the boss, so he started doing the runs with Professor Halsey. And even though he kept doing his strength training, he basically found that his strength was going down. Even though he was trying to train his powerlifting as much as he could, all of this running that he was doing with Professor Halsey seemed to be affecting his ability and his strength. And so he was talking with him, with the boss, about this during one of their runs, and the boss turned to him and said that this is what you should do as your first study when you have your own laboratory. And that's, in fact, what he did. And so in 1980, he did that, but he published in 1980 that first experiment where he took a group of individuals and he had them do strength training alone as one group. He had them do endurance training alone as another group. And then he had a third group do both strength and endurance training. And basically, again, he was a powerlifter. He was a very serious individual about his training. So this was not just, okay, go out for a jog or go sit on the bike. And it was on the bicycle days. So 3 days a week, the endurance training group would bicycle 5 minutes at as hard as they could go with 1 minute rest. And they would do that 6 to 8 times. When they went out for their run, they would go out as hard as they physically could and go as far as they could in the first week, 30 minutes, by the fourth week, they were doing 45 minutes, where they were going as hard as they could for those 45 minutes, trying to get further each time they ran. And then he would have them lifting, the strength group was lifting their legs 5 days a week, or 4 to 5 days a week, where they're doing just huge amounts of leg strength training work. And then the combined group combined both of those workouts. So you can imagine that this is not an easy level of commitment here, because you're doing a huge amount of strength work, a huge amount of endurance work. And so what he found is something that's had probably been noted most by elite athletes. What they found is that strength would go up in the strength group, and it would continue to go up through the 12 weeks that they did the study. In the endurance training group, because they weren't doing any strength training, they didn't really see an increase in strength at all. They saw maybe a 5% increase, probably due to the cycling, because there is a little bit of a strength component for the legs there. The most interesting one was when you combine both of the workouts. What happened was the strength went up in that group up until about 7 weeks, and it went up the same rate as the strength alone group. But when you got to about 7 weeks, then what happened was that group that did the combined or the concurrent training, what happened is they would no longer get any stronger. And in fact, they got weaker over the next 3 to 4 weeks. And so what that tells us is that if you are going to do strength and endurance together, and if you're going to do the type of sessions that we're talking about with Higson, where that was 11 sessions a week, that if you're doing 10 or 11 sessions a week, you're going to have to pick at some point whether you want to get a bigger, stronger muscle, or whether you're going to want to get more endurance. For most of us, this is not a problem. This is not a problem because most of us aren't going to train more than 5 or 6 times a week at most. So this is really a problem for our lead athletes. And I'll give you an example. So a colleague of mine, Trent Stellenworth, has worked as the physiologist for the Canadian rowing team. And the Canadian men's rowing 8 is the best example. So these are gentlemen who are about 6'5" tall. They weigh about 240, 250 pounds. Their performance is proportional to their size. The bigger they are, the better they'll perform. They train 25 hours a week in rowing. And what that means is 25 hours a week, they are consuming about 8,000, 8,500 calories a day. And they're losing muscle mass and they're losing weight. And I always tell my students that we all think that it would be spectacular to be able to eat 8,500 calories a day, because that's basically eating whatever you want, as much as you want, all the time. But for these elite performers, what happens is you get to a point where you can't take in enough calories to feed that muscle mass, to maintain the muscle mass, and that's affecting their performance. So that's when we see this concurrent training effect, is when you've got sessions. Probably what we think is it's 7 to 10 sessions a week. Anything over 7 sessions a week, you're going to get the possibility of inhibiting some of your strength or muscle mass adaptation. There's been a lot of work trying to figure out what the molecular mechanism is. And for a long time, we thought it was a relationship between kind of an energy sensor within your muscle, and this is the AMP, activated protein kinase, and the kinase that we were talking about before, which was mTOR complex 1. And there's really nice work in individual cells and in cancer cells that shows that the AMP activated protein kinase can inhibit mTOR. And so if you're activating AMP kinase with your endurance exercise, which we know that you do, then the idea was that AMP kinase activation is going to block mTOR, and it's going to cause you to not have the type of growth response that you're looking for, and your muscle's not going to get stronger. One of the big problems with that is that we had discovered that the AMP kinase that's important for slowing down mTOR or blocking mTOR activity is alpha-1. It's a flavor. So there's two forms of AMP activated protein kinase. There's an alpha-1 form and there's an alpha-2 form. The alpha-1 form seems to be blocking mTOR activity and growth of muscle. And we know that because there's a French group that's knocked it out, that's taken it out of a mouse. And when they do an overload stimulus, that mouse's muscle grows 30% more than normal muscle. So alpha-1 is the one that's blocking growth. The interesting thing is that it's alpha-2 that we activate when we do our endurance exercise. And now there's a couple of nice papers from William Apro out of Sweden, who's shown that in human muscle, you can activate AMP kinase and still get normal activation of mTOR after resistance exercise. Mm. And so it's not as simple as this switch between AMP kinase and mTOR. But what we do think is that it's more of an evolutionary process where you do so much activity that you're basically in a fasted state, because you can't regenerate your food stores enough. And when you're in a fasted state, you don't want to build a tissue that is really metabolically costly like muscle. And so there's a series of events that we think are blocking our ability to activate mTOR and protein synthesis in muscle when we do a lot of endurance exercise. And a lot of it is related to what happens in fasting or what happens in stresses like aging or in other types of stress that our bodies go through, where we get into a situation where we can't grow our muscle as much. And so we and a number of other groups are trying to figure out which of these proteins are going to be important in it. Because again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, okay, if we can identify the molecular transducer of this response, then what we can do is we can figure out ways that we can either shut it off using specific nutrients or in other ways that we can magnify the response we get from the exercise training.
Do we know which form of AMPK is activated by things like metformin or ketogenic diets, you know, that?
Well, it depends on what the stimulus is. So when we're fasting, we think that activates alpha-1, but we don't know what happens as far as which one's activated by the ketogenic diet.
That'd be interesting.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, as you see people not losing muscle, and some sports like wrestling, all the lightweight guys are in ketosis much of the year due to starvation and exercise, frankly, right?
Yeah. But they do use that as a way to drop weight quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're not just losing fat mass there. A lot of them are losing muscle mass as well. But what you can do is you can prevent that. And basically, how we think it works is that the amino acids that normally are activated mTOR from your feeding, they bind to a few proteins that are actually those inhibitor proteins of mTOR. When the amino acids bind, you can overcome the inhibition of mTOR. Mm. You just need more amino acids to overcome it. And so that's why when they go into this ketogenic diet phase, they increase their amino acid content or the protein content of their diet.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good answer.
So, Keith, you had mentioned that you eventually accepted a position at Michigan where you worked with Bob Dennis, who had figured out how to engineer muscle as well as tendons and ligaments. Can you share with us some of the research that you were doing with him?
Yeah, so Bob is probably one of the smartest people that I've ever had the pleasure to meet. As an 18-year-old, he was working for McDonnell Douglas as an independent problem solver. So he would go in and ask PhDs what they were working on, and he would actually solve their problems. So off the charts intelligent guy, he had figured out how to make muscle in a dish. I went there, learned how to make the muscle, and then we extended it while I was there. We started to try and figure out how to put a muscle onto a machine, because the idea was that we were going to use muscles to power machines. But the interface, every time we put a muscle onto a machine, it would pull away from the machine right at the interface. And that's when we knew that we had to kind of make a tendon. And so we started trying to engineer these tendons while I was there. And then that's transitioned into basically learning how to engineer muscle, but also tendons and ligaments. And now we've been able to use those to really figure out a lot of what's happening in tendons and ligaments with age, nutrition, and exercise.
And after Michigan, you accepted a position at the University of Dundee in Scotland. You were there for 5 years. So what was that experience like?
That was a kid in the candy store experience. It was basically going to Scotland to a place which is the best life science institute in Europe, where the person who discovered AMP kinase was the chair of my department. The person who discovered how mTOR is activated by protein kinase B and discovered protein kinase B was the chair of the whole institute. Every molecule that I had been studying in how is mTOR activated by exercise, they were all basically discovered in Dundee. So it was really a joyous place to go. We'd have Nobel Prize winners come in and give talks. And so it was a wonderful place to start a laboratory. And the other great thing is we'd have great students. And so one of my first students there was I had a number of great students, but two that really stand out in this area was Lee Hamilton, he's a Northern Irish former boxer who came in and did a lot of the mTOR work in the laboratory. We had Jennifer Paxton. She came in and she did the first engineered ligament that went from bone to bone. And the reason that she was interested is because she had been a concert level violinist. And what happened was her career was cut short when one of the tendons in one of her fingers ruptured. And so she was no longer able to play the violin at that level anymore, but she wanted to really understand how these tendons and ligaments worked. She got her PhD after doing 2.5 years of research. So that gives you an idea as to how incredibly good she was. And she engineered the first ligaments from bone to bone. And then I had a guy, Alistair Kotobakis, who was able to engineer muscles probably better than anybody else in the world. So just the opportunities were incredible. And what we were doing there is we were really starting to get a much better idea as to the actual molecular components that were important in the activation of mTOR. And more importantly, what we discovered was there's a whole lot of breaks that go on. And so if we want to grow a muscle and we have a stimulus to grow a muscle, we think that that's good. But because we evolved in a period where we didn't have much by way of nutrients, that's really costly. So there's actually huge numbers. We identified at least 4 different breaks that come on molecularly that try and keep muscle growth in check. And so what we're basically doing when we're trying to grow muscle really big is we're trying to overcome all these evolutionary processes that have developed to keep our muscles relatively small, make them big enough so that they're functional, but not so big that they're metabolically costly, so that if we go into a period of famine, we're then going to need more energy than we can supply. And that would put us at risk of dying faster. And so what we were doing in Scotland is really identifying some of these important breaks that were basically limitations that we needed to overcome to grow muscles bigger and stronger. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that was really important was getting a chance to work with some of the professional teams, because that's where I discovered one of the most important things that I found in the UK was working with British Cycling. And the British cycling team came to me and they brought me in. I was talking about how to make muscle bigger. And they said, we don't want bigger muscle because that weighs more and that's going to cause our athletes to go slower. We want stronger muscles without them getting bigger. And by definition, if you look in the textbook, muscle strength is proportional to mass. So the only way to get stronger was to get your muscle bigger. And then you go into their data from all of their elite athletes, and what they had showed me was, here are all these athletes who are getting significantly stronger in their legs while their legs are getting smaller, while their body weight is getting smaller. And that really challenged a lot of what we were doing at the time, which was only about regulating mass instead of regulating strength. And really, it's function that's the most important within this tissue, because muscle strength is what is going to increase longevity in humans, because that's what's correlated really well with longevity in humans. Muscle strength is going to improve performance at any age. And so that started us trying to figure out how a muscle could get stronger, but stay the same or even be a little bit smaller. And that's really been the focus of the laboratory since that time in Scotland.
Mm. Yes, from looking at the literature, it seems that you discovered that the non-contractile portion of the muscle plays a key role in the transfer of force, and that this is nearly as important as the size of the muscle fiber itself. Can you briefly elaborate on that?
Yeah, so we think of muscle as these motor proteins that interact and cause contraction. And that's really an essential part of it. But there's a number of groups that had shown that actually, the ability to transmit the force not along the length of the fiber, but to the outside, what we call lateral force transmission, was actually as important or more important than to be able to transmit it along the length. 80% of the force at least gets transmitted laterally. And what that does is that protects the muscle fibers from injury. And this is essential, and we know that it's essential, because one of the important proteins in this process is a protein called dystrophin. And we all know the protein dystrophin because it's mutated in muscular dystrophy. And the phenotype of that disease is that the boys with that disease, they get lots of muscle injury. The muscle gets progressively weaker and smaller, and they eventually are going to die because of a loss of muscle function. And what we discovered looking at some of the data that we were collecting in older muscles is that in older muscles, what we're finding is that the older muscles are losing dystrophin as well. And so in normal aging, in the animals that we use, in normal aging, what we're seeing is that there's a drop in dystrophin. And the drop in dystrophin makes the muscle more prone to injury when we do contraction. And so the result is that the muscle, when you do an exercise, if you're older and you have less dystrophin, what happens is you get more injury. Instead of getting a stimulus for your muscle to grow, you now have a stimulus for it to regenerate. So you might be able to turn on protein synthesis and do all of these things. But the proteins we're making are different. Instead of making motor proteins that are going to make it bigger and stronger, what we're doing in the old is we're having to fix all the damage that we've made. And so we've done a series of experiments looking at how these proteins are regulated. And there's really good work from my postdoc at the time, Dave Hughes, who had shown that, yes, in older muscles, we're seeing a loss of dystrophin. It's being caused, we think, by a microRNA, which prevents the dystrophin mRNA from being translated. And that microRNA, basically, if we increase the amount of it, dystrophin protein goes down in the muscle. And if we decrease it, we've got a paper that should be out in the Journal of Physiology in the next week or two. What that paper is going to show is that when we use a sponge to sponge up all of that microRNA, we increase the dystrophin in the muscle of old animals. Mm. And then when we do an exercise, the old animals get less injury from the exercise. So that the contraction-induced injury that we see in old muscle is due to a loss in dystrophin to a large degree. Mm. And we know that in humans with heart disease, with cancer, with diabetes, you actually see a drop in dystrophin as well. And so it seems like as we age or as we go through diseases, we're actually becoming dystrophic. And that's one of the reasons that our function deteriorates with age.
That's fascinating. Hmm. Has your work elucidated a potential countermeasure to the loss of dystrophin? I would think that for the aging population and also for perhaps cancer patients suffering cachexia, that could be important.
Yeah, definitely. So there's beautiful work from the University of California, San Diego, from a researcher there who has shown that if he takes people who have almost no dystrophin in their muscle because they've got serious heart disease or they've got cancer, and he actually feeds them a diet that contains high epicatechin rich chocolates, what he can do is he sees that the level of dystrophin increases in their muscle. Their muscles function better, their muscle structure is better, and they've seen an increase in their aerobic capacity without having to do exercise. The reason for that is that if your muscle is actually got low dystrophin, if it's got very poor structure, it doesn't function well. With the epicatechin-rich cocoa, what seems to happen is that proteins that are involved in helping force transfer occur, those proteins increase. The muscle is now better able to transmit force. It then takes on a better structure, and it can function at a much higher degree. And so it's one of the easiest things to get people to do, which is to have them eat chocolate in the morning. Yeah. But it seems like just getting them to eat chocolate in the morning, especially for individuals who are suffering from cancer cachexia or from sarcopenia or from other age-associated or disease-associated muscle problems, that this might be a very simple way that you can get in and actually have a very significant effect on muscle function.
That's interesting. Some athletes I know are using transdermal epicatechin. One wonders about the efficacy there.
Yeah, the transdermal things, basically what you worry about is that it's delivery. Is it being delivered systemically? Because we don't necessarily think that the epicatechin is having a direct effect. It might have a direct effect on muscle, but it might be working by changing the inflammatory status within the individual. And so if it's working by altering inflammation, if you have a transdermal that's going to be more locally administered, it's not going to have the big effect that you're looking for. But we've used it dietarily in athletes that are getting into their 30s or mid-30s, where you basically, these athletes, they tell you the same thing every time, which is, I do the same workout and it makes me more sore and it takes me longer to recover. And that's completely consistent with the idea that you do the same workout, you have more damage and more injury, which means that your muscle's more sore a day or 2 days later, and it takes you longer to get back again. And so with those athletes, we've been using the epicatechin-rich cocoa, and we've been seeing some good results.
That's very interesting.
STEM Talk.
Wow, Keith certainly has done a ton of groundbreaking research over the years. It was so much fun talking with Keith, and I think that our listeners will be particularly interested in the second part of our interview, where we talk to Keith about the work he is doing that not only has implications for helping athletes, but also has a potential to extend people's health span.
Indeed, I've been a fan of Keith's research for a number of years, and while I thoroughly enjoyed part one of our interview, part two has the most meat. And we get to dig into the research he is doing on a ketogenic diet and its potential to increase health span as well as lifespan. Like you said, Dawn, Keith is certainly doing a lot of groundbreaking research.
Yes, he is. If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.